Chapter 26. In So Harbor. As it happened, Niald, who had had to remain to hold the gateway open till Kirayan and the Gildanin were through, had placed the hole in the air very close to where he aimed. He and Kirayan caught up at a gallop just as Perrin topped a rise and drew rein with the town of So Harbor in front of him, on the other side of a small river, crossed by a pair of arching timber bridges. Perrin was no soldier, but he knew right away why Massima had left this place alone. Hard against the river, the town had two massive stone walls dotted with towers around it, the inner rising taller than the outer. A pair of barges were tied to a long wharf that ran along the river wall from bridge to bridge, yet the wide bridge gates, iron-strapped and closed tight, seemed to be the only openings in that expanse of rough gray stone, and battlements topped the whole length of it. Built to hold off greedy neighboring nobles, So Harbor would have had little fear of the prophet's rabble, even if they came by thousands. Anyone wanting to break into this town would need siege engines and patience, and Massima was more comfortable terrorizing villages and towns without walls or defenses.
"Well, it's glad I am to see people on the walls over there," Niald said. "I was beginning to think everyone in this country was dead and buried."
He sounded only half-joking, and his grin looked forced.
"As long as they're alive enough to sell grain," Kirayan murmured in his nasal, bored voice.
Unbuckling his silvery white-plumed helmet, he lifted it down to the tall pommel of his saddle. His eyes swept past Perrin and paused briefly on Berylane before he twisted around to address the Aes Sedai in the same weary tone.
"Are we going to sit here or go down?"
Berylane arched an eyebrow at him, a dangerous look, as a man with any brains would see. Kirayan did not see. Perrin's hackles were still trying to stand, the more so since seeing the town. Maybe it was just the part of him that was wolf, disliking walls. But he did not think so. The people atop the walls pointed toward them, and some held looking glasses. Those at least would be able to make out the banners clearly. Everyone would be able to see the soldiers, with the streamers on their lances floating on a morning breeze, and the first few carts of the line that stretched down the road out of their sight. Maybe everyone from the farms was crowded into the town.
"We didn't come here to sit," he said.
Berylane and Anura between them had laid out how to approach So Harbor. The local lord or lady had surely heard of Shido depredations not many miles to the north of them, and they might have heard of the prophet's presence in Altara too. Either thing was enough to make anyone wary. Together, they might be enough to make people loose arrows and wait till after to ask who they had shot. In any case, it was highly unlikely they would welcome outland soldiers through their gates at the moment. The lancers remained spread along the rise, a show that these visitors possessed some armed might, even if they chose not to employ it. Not so that So Harbor would be overly impressed by 100 men, but the burnished armor of the Gildanin and the red armor of the winged guards said the visitors were not wandering tricksters. The Two Rivers men would impress no one until they used their bows, so they remained back with the carts to hold up the cart driver's spirits. It was all an elaborate bit of nonsense, fluff and feathers, but Perrin was a country blacksmith no matter who called him lord. The first of Mayen and an Aes Sedai should know what they were about in a thing like this. Galen led the way down to the river at a slow walk, bright crimson helmet resting on his saddle, his back straight. Perrin and Berylane rode a little way behind, with Seonid between them, and Masuri and Anura to either side. The Aes Sedai with their hoods thrown back, so anyone on those walls who could recognize an Aes Sedai face would have the opportunity to see three. Aes Sedai were welcomed most places, even where people really would rather not. At their backs came all four bannermen, with the warders spaced among them in their eye-wrenching cloaks. And Kirayan, with his shining helmet balanced on his thigh, sour-mouthed at being relegated to riding with the warders, and now and then glaring coldly down his nose at Balwar, who trailed at the rear with his two companions. No one had told Balwar he could come, yet no one had said he could not. He bobbed a bow whenever the nobleman looked at him, then went back to studying the town walls ahead. Perrin could not shake his uneasiness as they drew nearer the town. The horses' hooves clattered hollowly on the southernmost bridge, a wide structure that rose high enough above the swift-flowing river to let a barge like those tied to the wharf pass easily underneath on sweeps. Neither of the broad, bluff-bowed craft had any provision for stepping a mast. One of those barges had settled deep in the water, slanting against taut mooring ropes, and the other somehow looked abandoned too. A rank sour smell in the air made him rub at his nose. No one else seemed to notice. Near the foot of the bridge, Galen drew up. The closed gates, covered with black iron straps a foot wide, would have forced a pause anyway.
"We have heard of the troubles plaguing this land,"
he bellowed at the men atop the wall, managing formality at the top of his lungs.
But we are merely passing through, and we come for trade, not trouble. To buy grain and other needful things, not to fight. I have the honor to announce Berlane Sir Paean Drag Peron, first of Mayen, blessed of the light, defender of the waves, high seat of House Peron, come to speak with the Lord O'Lady of this land. I have the honor to announce Perrin Tabashir Ebarra.
He tossed in Lord of the Two Rivers for Perrin, and several other titles that Perrin had no more right to, and had never heard before. Then went on for the Aes Sedai, giving each the full honorific, and adding her Aja as well. It was a very impressive recital. When he fell silent, there was silence. In the crenellations above, dirty-faced men exchanged bleak looks and fierce whispers, shifting crossbows and polearms nervously. Only a few wore helmets, or any sort of armor. Most were in rough coats, but on one man, Perrin thought he saw what might have been silk under a layer of grime. It was hard to tell with so much caked dirt. Even his ears could not make out what they were saying.
"How do we know you're alive?"
a hoarse voice shouted down at last. Berylane blinked in surprise, but no one laughed. It was fool talk, yet Perrin thought the hair on the back of his neck really was standing stiff. Something was very wrong here. The Aes Sedai seemed not to sense it. Then again, Aes Sedai could hide anything behind those smooth masks of cool serenity. The beads in Inura's thin braids clicked faintly as she shook her head. Masuri ran an icy gaze along the men on the wall.
"If I must prove I am alive, you will regret it," Siona denounced loudly in crisp Kyrianan accents, a little more heated than her face suggested. "If you continue to point that crossbow at me, you will regret it even more."
Several of the men hastily raised their crossbows to point at the sky. Not all, though. More whispers rustled along the top of the wall, but someone must have recognized Aes Sedai. At last, the gates squealed open on massive rusty hinges. A gagging stench swept out of the town. The stink Perrin had been smelling only stronger. Old dirt and old sweat, decaying middens and chamber pots too long unemptied. Perrin's ears tried to lie back. Galen half lifted his red helmet as if to replace it on his head before urging his dun through the gates. Perrin booted Steyr to follow, easing his axe in its belt loop. Just inside the gate, a filthy man in a torn coat poked Perrin's leg with a finger, then darted back when Steyr snapped at him. The fellow had been fat once, but his coat sagged and his skin hung loose.
"Just wanted to be sure," he muttered, scratching his side absently. "Milord," he added a tick late.
His eyes seemed to focus on Perrin's face for the first time, and his scratching fingers froze. Golden yellow eyes were not a common sight, after all.
"Do you see many dead men walking?" Perrin asked wryly, trying to make a joke of it as he patted the bay's neck. A trained warhorse wanted to be rewarded for protecting his rider.
The fellow flinched as if the horse had bared his teeth at him again. His mouth twitched into a rictus smile, and he edged sideways, until he bumped solidly into Berylane's mare. Galen was right behind her, still looking ready to don his helmet, his one eye trying to watch six ways at once.
"Where can I find your lord or lady?" she demanded impatiently.
Mayen was a small nation, but Berylane was unaccustomed to being ignored.
"Everyone else seems to have gone mute, but I heard you use your tongue. Well, man, speak up."
The fellow stared up at her, licking his lips.
Lord Cowan is away, m'lady."
His eyes darted toward Perrin, then flickered away.
"The grain merchants, they're who you want. They can always be found at the Golden Barge, that way."
He thrust out a hand, pointing vaguely deeper into the town, then suddenly scrambled away, looking back over his shoulder at them as though fearful of pursuit.
"I think we should find somewhere else," Perrin said.
That fellow had been afraid of more than yellow eyes. This place felt askew.
"We are already here, and there is nowhere else," Berylane replied in a very practical tone.
In all that stink, he could not catch her scent. He would have to go by what he heard and saw, and her face was calm enough for an Aes Sedai.
"I have been in towns that smelled worse than this, Perrin. I'm sure I have. And if this Lord Cowan is gone, it won't be the first time I've dealt with merchants. You don't really believe they've seen the dead walking, do you?"
What was a man to say to that without sounding a pure woolhead? In any case, the others were already crowding through the gates, though not in any neat array now. Winter and O'Hara heeled Sionid like mismatched guard dogs, the one fair, the other dark, and both ready to rip out throats at the blink of an eye. They certainly had the feel of So Harbor. Kirkland, riding beside Missouri, looked unwilling to wait for that eye to blink. His hand rested on the hilt of his sword. Kerayan had a hand to his nose and a glare in his eye that said someone was going to pay for making him smell this. Midori and Lashin looked ill, too, but Balwar merely peered about, tilting his head, then drew the pair of them off into a narrow side street leading north. As Berylane said, they were there already. The colorful banners looked decidedly out of place as Perrin rode through the cramped, winding streets of the town. Some of the streets were actually quite wide for the size of So Harbor, but they felt close, as if the stone buildings on either side somehow loomed higher than their 2 or 3 stories and were about to topple on his head to boot. Imagination made the streets seem dim, too. It had to be imagination. The sky was not that gray. People filled the dirty stone paving, but not enough to account for all the farms in the area being abandoned, and everyone scurried, heads down. Not hurrying toward something, hurrying away. No one looked at anyone else. With a river practically on their doorsteps, they had forgotten how to wash, too. He did not see a face without a coating of grime, or a garment that did not look to have been worn for a week, and hard work in muck with it. The stink only worsened the deeper into the town they rode. He supposed you could get used to anything in time. Worst of all was the quiet, though. Villages were quiet sometimes, if not so still as the woods, but a town always had a faint murmur, the sound of shopkeepers bargaining and people going about their lives. So Harbor did not even whisper. It barely seemed to breathe. Getting better directions was difficult, since most people darted away if spoken to, but eventually they dismounted in front of a prosperous-appearing inn, 3 stories of neatly dressed gray stone under a slate roof with a sign hanging out front announcing the Golden Barge. The sign even had a touch of gilt in the lettering, and on the grain mounted high in the barge and uncovered as it never would be for shipping. No grooms appeared from the stableyard beside the inn, so the bannermen had to serve as horseholders, a task that did not make them happy. Todd put so much attention into peering at the flow of dirty people that scurried by and fondling the hilt of his short sword that Steyr very nearly got a couple of his fingers when he took the stallion's reins. The Mayenner and the Gildannon seemed to be wishing they had lances rather than banners. Flan just looked wild-eyed. In spite of the morning sun, the light did seem shadowy. Going inside did not make things any better. At first glance, the common room bore the inn's prosperity, with polished round tables and proper chairs instead of benches, standing beneath a high, stout-beamed ceiling. The walls were painted with fields of barley and oats and millet, ripening under a bright sun, and a colorfully painted clock stood on the carved mantel above a wide fireplace of white stone. The fireplace was cold, though, the air nearly as icy as outside. The clock had run down and the polish dulled. Dust lay on everything. The only people in the room were 6 men and 5 women, huddling over their drinks around an oval table, larger than the rest, that stood in the middle of the floor. One of the men leaped to his feet with an oath, face paling underneath the dirt, when Perrin and the others entered. A plump woman with lank, greasy hair shoved her pewter cup to her mouth and tried to gulp so fast that wine spilled over her chin. Maybe it was his eyes. Maybe.
"What happened in this town?" Honora said firmly, tossing back her cloak as though a fire blazed on the hearth.
The calm gaze she ran across the people at the table froze every one of them. Abruptly, Perrin realized that neither Missouri nor Sionid had followed him inside. He doubted very much that they were waiting in the streets with the horses. What they and their warders were doing was any man's guess. The man who had jumped up tugged at his coat collar with a finger. The coat had been fine blue wool once, with a row of gilded buttons to his neck. But he appeared to have been spilling food down the front of it for some time, maybe more than had gone into him. He was another whose skin hung slack.
"Happened, Aes Sedai,"
he stammered.
"Be quiet, Michael,"
a haggard woman said quickly. Her dark dress was embroidered on the high neck and along the sleeves, but dirt made the colors uncertain. Her eyes were sunken pits.
"What makes you think something happened, Aes Sedai?"
Honora would have continued, but Berylane stepped in as the Aes Sedai opened her mouth again.
"We are looking for the grain merchants."
Honora's expression never changed, but her mouth snapped shut with an audible click. Long looks passed between the people around the table. The haggard woman studied Anura for a moment, quickly passing on to Berylaine and obviously taking in the silks and fire drops. And the diadem. She spread her skirts in a curtsy.
"We are the Merchant's Guild of So Harbor, milady. What's left of—"
Breaking off, she took a deep, shuddering breath.
"I am Rahima Arnon, milady. How may we serve you?"
The merchants seemed to brighten a little on learning that their visitors had come for grain and other things that they could supply. Oil for lamps and cooking, beans and needles and horseshoe nails, cloth and candles and a dozen things more that the camp needed. At least they grew a little less fearful. Any ordinary merchant, hearing the list Berylaine gave, would have been hard-pressed not to smile greedily. But this lot... Mistress Arnon shouted for the innkeeper to bring wine.
"The best wine! Quickly now! Quickly!"
But when a long-nosed woman stuck her head hesitantly into the common room, Mistress Arnon had to rush over and catch her soiled sleeve to keep her from vanishing again. The fellow in the food-stained coat called for someone named Sparrow to bring the sample jars, but after shouting three times with no response, he gave a nervous laugh and darted into a back room to return a moment later, his arms around three large cylindrical wooden containers that he sat on the table, still laughing nervously. The others wore a collection of twitching smiles as they bowed and curtsied Berylaine to a seat at the head of the oval table, greasy-faced men and women scratching at themselves without appearing to notice what they were doing. Perrin tucked his gauntlets behind his belt and stood against a painted wall, watching. They had agreed to leave the bargaining to Berylaine. She was willing to admit, reluctantly, that he knew more of horseflesh than she, but she had negotiated treaties covering the sale of years' worth of the oilfish harvest. Anura had smiled thinly at the suggestion that a jumped-up country lad might take a hand. She did not call him that. She could milord him as smoothly as Masuri or Sionid. Yet it was clear she thought some things clearly above his ability. She was not smiling now, standing behind Berylaine and studying the merchants, as if to memorize their faces. The innkeeper brought wine, in pewter cups that had last seen a polishing cloth weeks ago, if not months, but Perrin only peered into his and swirled it in the cup. Mistress Vadir, the innkeeper, had dirt under her fingernails and embedded in her knuckles like part of her skin. He noticed that Galen, standing with his back to the opposite wall and one hand on his sword hilt, only held his cup too, and Berylaine never touched hers. Kirayan sniffed at his, then drank deeply and called for Mistress Vadir to bring him a pitcher.
"Thin stuff, to be called your best,"
he told the woman through his nose and looking down it.
"But it might wash away the stink."
She stared at him blankly, then fetched a tall pewter pitcher to his table without saying a word. Kirayan apparently took her silence for respect. Master Crossan, the fellow in the food-stained coat, unscrewed the tops of the wooden containers and spilled out hulled samples of the grain they had to offer in piles on the table. Yellow millet and brown oats, the barley only a little darker brown. There would have been no rain before the harvest.
"The finest quality, as you can see," he said. "Yes, the finest."
The smile slid off Mistress Arnon's face, and she jerked it back.
"We sell only the finest."
For people touting their wares as the finest, they did not seem to bargain very hard. Perrin had watched men and women back home selling the wool clip and the tabak to merchants down from Berlan, and they always disparaged the buyer's offers, sometimes complaining the merchants were trying to beggar them when the price was twice what it had been the year before, or even suggesting they might wait till next year to sell it all. It was a dance as intricate as any at a feast day.
"I suppose we might lower the price further for such a large quantity," a balding man told Berylaine, scratching at his gray-streaked beard.
It was cut short, and greasy enough to cling close to his chin. Perrin wanted to scratch his own beard just watching the fellow.
"It's been a hard winter,"
a round-faced woman muttered. Only two of the other merchants bothered to frown at her. Perrin set his wine cup down on a nearby table and walked over to the gathering in the middle of the room. Anura gave him one sharp warning glance, but several of the merchants looked at him curiously. And cautiously. Galen had made his introductions all over again, but these folk were not entirely clear where Mayen was exactly, or how powerful, and the Two Rivers only meant good tabak to them. Two Rivers tabak was known everywhere. If not for the presence of an Aes Sedai, his eyes might have set them running. Everyone fell silent as Perrin scooped up a handful of millet, the tiny spheres smooth and vivid yellow on his palm. This grain was the first clean thing he had seen in the town. Letting the grain spill back onto the table, he picked up the lid of one of the containers. The threads cut into the wood were sharp and unworn. The lid would fit tightly. Mistress Arnon's eyes slid away from his, and she licked her lips. I want to see the grain in the warehouses, he said. Half the people around the table twitched. Mistress Arnon drew herself up, blustering.
We don't sell what we don't have. You can watch our laborers load every sack on your carts if you wish to spend hours in the cold.
I was about to suggest a visit to a warehouse, Berylaine put in.
Rising, she drew her red gloves from behind her belt and began tugging them on.
I would never buy grain without seeing the warehouse.
Mistress Arnon sagged. The bald-headed man put his head down on the table. No one said anything, though. The dispirited merchants did not bother to fetch their cloaks before leading them into the street. The breeze had picked up to a wind, cold as only a late winter wind could be, when people were already thinking ahead to spring, but they did not seem to notice. The hunch of their shoulders had nothing to do with cold.
Can we go now, Lord Perrin?
Flan asked anxiously when Perrin and the others appeared.
This place makes me want a bath.
Anura gave him a frown in passing that made him flinch like one of the merchants. Flan tried a placating smile on her, but it was a sickly effort and too late for anything but her back.
As soon as I can arrange it, Perrin said.
The merchants were already scurrying down the street, heads down and not looking at anyone. Berylaine and Anura managed to follow without appearing to rush, gliding along, one as composed as the other, two fine ladies out for a stroll and never mind the filth underfoot or the stink in the air, or the dirty people who started at the sight of them and sometimes all but ran away as fast as they could. Galen had finally donned his helmet and openly held his sword hilt with both hands ready to draw. Gireon was carrying his helmet on his hip, his other hand occupied with his wine cup. Contemptuously eyeing the grimy-faced folk who hurried by, he sniffed at the wine as if it were a pomander to fight off the stench of the town. The warehouses were located on a stone-paved street, barely wider than a wagon, between the town's two walls. The smell was better there, close to the river, but the wind-blown street was empty except for Perrin and the others. There was not even a stray dog to be seen. Dogs disappeared when a town grew hungry, but why would a town with enough grain to sell be hungry? Perrin pointed to a two-story warehouse chosen at random, no different from any other, a windowless stone building with a wide pair of wooden doors held shut by a wooden bar that could have done for a ceiling beam at the Golden Barge. The merchants suddenly recalled that they had forgotten to bring men to lift the bars. They offered to go back for them. The Lady Berylaine and Anura Sedai could rest in front of the fire at the Golden Barge while workmen were fetched. They were sure Mistress Vidir would lay a fire. Their tongues went still when Perrin placed his hand beneath the thick beam and shoved it up out of the wooden brackets. The thing was heavy, but he backed up with it to give him room to turn and toss it down the street with a crash. The merchants stared. This might have been the first time they had ever seen a man in a silk coat do anything that could be called work. Gireon rolled his eyes and took another sniff at his wine.
Lanterns, Mistress Arnon said weakly. We'll need lanterns or torches if...
A ball of light appeared floating above Anura's hand, glowing bright enough in the gray morning to cast everyone in faint shadows on the paving and the stone walls. Some of the merchants put hands up to shield their eyes. After a moment, Master Crossan tugged one of the doors open by an iron ring. The smell inside was the familiar sharp scent of barley, almost strong enough to overcome the stench of the town. And something more. Small, dim shapes slunk away into the shadows ahead of Anura's light. He could have seen better without it, or at least deeper into the darkness. The glowing ball cast a large pool of light, and walled off what lay beyond. He smelled cat, closer to feral than not, and rat, too. A sudden squeal in the black depths of the warehouse, suddenly cut off, spoke of cat meeting rat. There were always rats in grain barns, and cats to hunt them. It was comforting, and normal. Almost enough to soothe his uneasiness. Almost. He smelled something else. A smell he should know. A fierce yowl deep in the warehouse turned to rising cries of pain that died abruptly. Apparently, the rats of Soul Harbor sometimes hunted back. Perrin's hackles stirred again, but surely there was nothing here the Dark One would want to spy on. Most rats were just rats. There was no need to go very far in. Coarse sacks filled the darkness in high, slant-sided stacks on low wooden platforms to keep the stacks off the stone floor. Rows and rows of stacks piled nearly to the ceiling, and likely the same on the floor above. If not, this building still held enough grain to feed his people for weeks. Walking to the nearest stack, He drove his belt knife into a pale brown sack and sliced down through the tough jute fibers. A flood of barleycorns spilled out, and, clear in the glow of Anura's brilliant light, wriggling black specks. Weevils, almost as many as there were barleycorns. Their scent was sharper than that of the barley. Weevils. He wished the hair on his neck would stop trying to rise. The cold should have been enough to kill weevils. That one sack was proof, and his nose knew the smell of weevils now, but he moved to another stack, then another and another, each time slicing open one sack. Each released a spill of pale brown barley and black weevils. The merchants were standing huddled together in the doorway, daylight behind them, but Anura's light cast their faces in sharp relief. Worried faces. Despairing faces.
"We would be most happy to winnow each sack we sell," Mistress Arnon said unsteadily, "for only a slight additional—"
"For half the last price I offered,"
Berlane cut in sharply. Wrinkling her nose in disgust, she moved her skirts clear of the weevils scuttling among the grain on the floor.
"You will never get all of them."
"And no millet,"
Perrin said grimly. His men needed food, and so did the soldiers, but the millet grains were hardly bigger than the weevils. Winnow as they would, he would bring back weevils and millet in equal weight.
"We'll take extra beans instead, but they get winnowed too."
Suddenly someone shrieked outside in the street. Not a cat or a rat, but a man in terror. Perrin did not even realize he had drawn his axe until he found the haft in his hand as he pushed through the merchants in the doorway. They huddled closer together, licking their lips, and not even trying to see who had screamed. Kirayan was backed up against the wall of a warehouse across the way, his shining helmet with the white plume lying on the pavement beside his wine cup. The man's sword was half out of the scabbard, but he seemed frozen, staring with bulging eyes at the wall of the building Perrin had just come out of. Perrin touched his arm, and he jumped.
"There was a man," the Gildanin said uncertainly. "He was just there. He looked at me and—"
Kirayan scrubbed a hand over his face. Despite the cold, sweat glistened on his forehead.
"He walked through the wall. He did. You must believe me."
Someone moaned. One of the merchants, Perrin thought.
"I saw the man too,"
Seonid said behind him, and it was his turn to give a start. His nose was useless in this place. Giving the wall Kirayan had indicated a last glance, the Aes Sedai stepped away from it with a palpable unwillingness. Her warders were tall men, towering over her, but they stayed only far enough away to gain room to draw their swords. Though what the grim-eyed warders were to fight if Seonid was serious, Perrin could not imagine.
"I find it difficult to lie, Lord Perrin," Seonid said dryly when he expressed doubt.
But her tone quickly became as serious as her face, and her eyes were so intent that they alone began to make Perrin feel uneasy.
"The dead are walking in So Harbor. Lord Cowlin fled the town for fear of his wife's spirit. It seems there was doubt as to how she died. Hardly a man or woman in the town has not seen someone dead, and a good many have seen more than one. Some say people have died from the touch of someone dead. I cannot verify that, but people have died of fright and others because of it. No one goes out at night in So Harbor or walks into a room unannounced. People strike out at shadows and surprises with whatever is to hand, and sometimes they have found a husband, wife, or neighbor dead at their feet. This is not hysteria or a tale to frighten children, Lord Perrin. I have never heard of the like, but it is real. You must leave one of us here to do what we can."
Perrin shook his head slowly. He could not afford to lose an Aes Sedai if he was to free Fael. Mistress Arnim began to weep even before he said,
"So Harbor will have to face its dead alone."
But fear of the dead only explained so much. Maybe people were too frightened to think of washing, but it seemed unlikely that fear would take everyone that way. They just did not seem to care anymore. And weevils, thriving in winter, in freezing cold? There was worse wrong in So Harbor than spirits walking, and every instinct told him to leave at a dead run without looking back. He purely wished that he could.